Hare Krishna. Yesterday we had a wonderful evening preaching program, continuation of our series that we had before with Radhanath Prabhu. We were talking about history and history from version of Bhagavatam and the Puranas. We also had on archaeology and the implications of archaeology. And that was with Amritananda Devidasi, and yesterday was with Manjari, and she did the Chitta Kabitani, which was the grammatical arrangement and the picturesque versions of the methodology of composing Sanskrit verses that read in different directions, that make up pictures like lotus, small lotus, drum. And it was a very mesmerizing presentation, a very enchanting presentation. I think the guests were really, really impressed. And from her, they saw how wonderful Sanskrit language was. Our acharyas, of course, this was Rupa Goswami, and his presentation of these verses, how flexible, in one sense, Sanskrit language is, at the same time, how very, very expressive it is. And after that, I gave a presentation, which I'll give a summary of, which was really the consequence of such a language, such a obviously, visually, very evolved, indeed, as the word Sanskrit itself means, a perfect language. What does that say about the culture or the peoples who employed that language? And so I cited different references of linguists, well-known linguists, who point out that language is the mirror of a culture, and that if you want to know about how people thought, acted, believed in a culture, then you examine their language. So obviously, if we work back from the perfect and very intricate nature of Sanskrit language, then we come to a implication on the basis of this, or a conclusion, that the culture that spoke, the peoples who spoke and used this language, had a very evolved consciousness, a very evolved method of expressing themselves. They thought about things and explored different realms that modern societies and cultures don't do. And they perfectly knew how to communicate these concepts to each other. Which, and this conclusion runs into the face of historians, anthropologists, and archaeologists who want to prove that the Vedic culture, or those who spoke the Sanskrit language, were a backward people, aborigines, and that their books were really myth, some kind of mythology that they made up in order to support their beliefs. So the two can't be right. Either the Vedic culture, with its evolved Sanskrit, was an evolved culture, or according to this materialistic point of view, it wasn't. But if we examine further the nature of Sanskrit language, and of course the literatures which it composed, then we see that not only was it evolved, but it's more evolved than at the present time. For instance, in Chinese, they have no real direct word for God. If you don't have a direct word for God, you only have that because you don't have a concept of God. It isn't that they couldn't compose a word. but it's because they didn't have a concept of God. There's sort of one word, a very interesting word, which I forget the actual meaning right now, but it means above the emperor. In other words, they had a concept of an emperor, but who is that, or what is it that's above the emperor? That's as sort of far as they got, but a direct appellation they don't have. Another example is, and something is, for instance, the word dharma, and many other Sanskrit words that we come across when translation into English or other languages is that there's no real equivalent. Sometimes dharma is translated as religion, sometimes it's translated as service, but actually dharma means the eternal function of the soul. And when you say the word dharma to someone who knows Sanskrit, then they know exactly what you're talking about. Now, why isn't it there's such a word as dharma, an equivalent of it in the English language? Because there's no such concept as the eternal function of the soul. Why is that? Because there's not even a concept of what the soul is, or to speak of what the soul's function would be. So therefore, you don't need a word to speak that. And the same is the case in other languages. Why? Because Western culture, or even global culture, which is in now the international language is English, is based on materialism. It's based on the identity that you're this body, not that you're soul. So therefore, the best that you can come to is religion, but religion means some type of faith. And that faith may or may not, and generally may not, include a clear idea of what the soul is, or what to speak of the soul's function in relationship to a personal God. So once again, we see that if culture is a mirror of a language, we see that modern cultures don't represent the same type of concepts as Vedic culture, or at least Sanskrit language does, of Vedic culture, because the conclusion then is that that Vedic culture was higher, it was better. And, of course, higher, better means that all of these concepts represent a certain level of consciousness, that ultimately language represents the consciousness of people. Then I brought up the concept of love. I asked them what's the most glorified experience that people talk about, and not just spiritual people, but materialistic people, and of course, love, love, love. Love is all you need. Everyone talks about love. But we only have one word for love. But there are different types of love. A man's love is different than a woman's love. A child's love is different than a parent's love. When you're angry, there's a different type of the love is different than when you're sad, or when you're in fear, or when you're happy, and there are also different gradations of love. But we only have one word. Whereas in Sanskrit, you have prema, sneha, man, rag, anurag, bhav, maharav, mahabhav, virudha mahabhav, avirudha mahabhav, and even divisions within these. So there are expressions of different types of love, and everybody immediately knows. So why? Because they knew how to express themselves better, but they weren't expressing themselves better about certain concepts, because they're also experiencing different types of love. So their experiences were more evolved, and of course, especially in the spiritual field, these things apply very much. These words were used also both for mundane love, but also used for spiritual. So once again, we see that here's a more evolved culture, and therefore, what have we got? We've got Aborigines, yes. The Indologists and the archaeologists and the historians are real Aborigines by compared to the people of the Vedic culture. And with a blindfold, they're trying to figure out what this other culture is by digging around in the ground and so on. And with a very stunted, limited consciousness, trying to appreciate something that at least you can theoretically accept that it's way beyond your consciousness to even understand. And that message, I think, got across quite nicely. There were different aspects of Vedic culture, of Vedic culture and also of Sanskrit that we explained, but one which was very good, and that was by Professor Hopkins, who very nicely summarized that the uniqueness of Sanskrit language is, as opposed to arbitrary conventional use of words, the words actually are the linguistic representation of objects, feelings, relationships, and so on. So, for instance, I've got this recorder in my hand. Now, this word recorder could have been called a micorder, it could have been called a nocorder, it could have been called so many other different things. And if that was the convention at the very beginning when it was invented, then that's what we would call it. Why? Because it doesn't really matter what it's called, it's just a name. And the name doesn't have any real connection to the object except for what we've assigned to it, just like an apple. The apple wasn't called an apple, but was called an orange, and everyone would be calling an apple an orange, and they would be calling an orange an apple. And that would work fairly well, because that's the convention, that's what everyone is used to. So we see that actually the language has very limited value. It doesn't really relate to reality. However, Hopkins points out that in Sanskrit language, the actual words themselves are the sound representation of that object, feeling, relationship, event, so on. So that, for instance, when we say the word Padma or lotus, that just like you see a picture of a lotus, and that picture is the visual representation of the actual object. It's a visual representation of reality. Similarly, when I say the word Padma is the sound vibrational or the auditory representation of reality, whereas the picture I see with my eyes, the sound I hear with my ears. But you can't change the word Padma to something else, because the word Padma is the lotus. It's the lotus in form of sound. And of course, Abhinatvannamanam, you know what to speak of when we talk about Krishna. So that the words themselves are fixed in connection with the things that they represent. In other words, that in Sanskrit, the words represent reality. One offshoot of this then is that mantras are able to manipulate matter. Why? Because they connect to the real objects or the real things themselves. So the Kshatriyas were able to invoke weapons. Why? Because the subtle form of the weapon in terms of sound was non-different than the weapon itself. Therefore, if you knew how to manipulate that, then you could invoke a weapon simply with that sound. So this is a very important thing, and we see very much the difference. And what does that reflect upon Vedic culture? It means that Vedic culture dealt with reality, both in the mundane as well as the transcendental sphere, whereas non-Vedic cultures just deal with illusion. So calling an apple is an illusory thing. It has nothing really to do with the reality of the apple. It's just a convention that one has adopted. So therefore, it's really misleading. So therefore, as a result of that, you can say apple, apple all you want, but you're not going to be eating an apple. You'll never be able to invoke the presence of an apple. So concluding like that, it becomes quite obvious that the culture of which was reflecting the Sanskrit language was such an evolved and perfect culture that we have to accept on the basis of the wonderful nature, extraordinary nature of Sanskrit language itself, that the cultures and the people were there. And therefore, that conclusion or the so-called mythology that's being spread about Vedic culture and the residents of India, especially in historic and prehistoric times, is false. And if we see that the Sanskrit language in itself is so evolved, then why not just take a very small leap of faith? It doesn't require a leap, it's just a step. Why not accept the Sanskrit language's version of Sanskrit? Why not accept the Sanskrit literature's version of where it comes from, what its people are like. Why immediately just write it off to mythology? It's much more reasonable, considering our less advanced nature in modern society, considering the more advanced nature of Vedic culture. Why not accept that when Sanskrit says that was directly spoken by Narayan, then when Srimad Bhagavatam says that Sanskrit language and that sound vibration is his very form, that we accept that. What to speak of everything else that Puranas and Itihasas and so on speak about Vedic culture and the history of not just India, but the world and the universe. Why not start off with the fact that it's more likely than they're right than our real speculative efforts of trying to discredit the actual words of the Vedic literature and trying to concoct something that fits into our own very little limited imagination. So that was it, and then we concluded by getting everyone to chant one nice verse of Srimad Bhagavatam, which in itself was one of Srila Prabhupada's favorite verses. Samashrita ye padapalavaplavam mahatpadam punya jasho murari bhavan buddhi vatsa param padam 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 yadvipadam natesham. And Prabhupada liked the beautiful rhyme and showed how wonderful both Sanskrit as well as Srimad Bhagavatam was. So that was our presentation yesterday, and Hare Krishna.